Yirmiyah Navi says in a pasuk, "Mia ish hachacham v'yavin azos." Who is the man that's wise and understands this matter? The Gemara explains to us that after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, there was a question, and that question was why. What was the sin? What was the fault? Where did the Klal Yisrael mess up so egregiously that HaKadosh Baruch Hu felt he not only had to destroy the Beis Hamikdash but exile us from the land? What was the chait? And the Gemara tells us that they searched, they asked and they asked. They asked Chachamim, they asked Nevi'im, and no one could identify it. No one could define it. No one could clearly say, Zuhi, this is the flaw, this is the fault, this is the sin. Ad kedei kach, that the Novi tells us, Hashem himself had to answer this question. Hashem himself had to answer the question, and that's the pasuk that Yirmiyah quotes. V'yomer Hashem al azvim es torasi, it's because you left my Torah. You weren't learning, you weren't osik in Torah, you weren't involved in Torah study. But that very same Gemara says, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, make no mistake. This does not mean the Klal Yisrael were not involved in Torah study. It does not mean they were not tremendously steeped in Torah study. Says Rav Yehuda Marav, what it really means is lo baruchu berchas tchila. They didn't make a bracha on their limud Torah. Granted, they learned, but they weren't involved in Torah study. The Ran is bothered by the obvious problem. Hashem said, you didn't study the Torah. Azavtem es torasi, you left my Torah. What right does Amar Rav Yehuda Marav, what right does an Amora, granted, maybe a Tana, what right does he have to say that it wasn't that they stopped learning, but it was that they stopped making brachas on the Torah? Explains the Ran very succinctly as following. If the Nevi'im and Chachamim were asked, what is the sin of this generation, and they couldn't identify it, what that means is ostensibly, on the face of it, the Klal Yisrael were acting as the Klal Yisrael should have. Torah learning was flourishing, and Torah learning was in abundance. There were yeshivas, there were bati midrashim. People were very, very involved in Torah learning. Ad kedei kach, until the point that it took actually HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who delves into a man's heart, to be able to say, granted they're learning, but their intentions are wrong. Their intentions are they're studying Torah as one would a science, as one would any worldly body of knowledge, but they're not making birchas a Torah, meaning they don't view it as Hashem's Torah. They don't view it as a mitzvah. They're studying for the knowledge. They're studying for the wisdom, but they're not studying because it's Hashem's Torah. They're not serving Torah. That's why Hashem says they left my Torah. What it really means is, Rav, it really means that they weren't machshiv. They didn't consider it important. They stopped making birchas a Torah. And that's a Gemara. And I believe that there are two obvious questions on this Gemara. Question number one is, if it's not a mitzvah, why are you learning? Limud HaTorah is a very, very difficult task. To be involved in Torah study 10 hours, 12 hours, 14 hours a day requires tremendous focus, tremendous effort. If they weren't doing it to serve Hashem, if they didn't view this as a mitzvah, why in the world were they learning? That's question one. But question number two is probably more profound. It is a famous chazal, and certainly in yeshivas, it's repeated over and over and over. Halavai osi ozvu. Hashem says, leave me, leave the mitzvahs. Sarasai tishmoru, but just learn Torah. As long as you learn the Or Sheba, the light of it will nachziran lamutav, will return you. Just keep learning. Torah empowers the neshama, and Torah gives you the chiyus, it gives you the strength. As long as you stay in learning, it will bring you back. That's a principle that we know. That's a principle that's rather famous. And the question is, if they were involved in Torah, how is it possible that they didn't return? How is it possible that the Torah didn't do its job? Question number one is, if it wasn't a mitzvah, why are they learning? But question number two is maybe even more important. And that is, if they were steeped in Torah study, if they had chaburas, if they had yeshivas, if they had bati midrashim and kolos, why is it that the Torah stopped doing that which the Torah does? Why didn't it have the effect that it should have? I'd like to see if we can answer these questions and hopefully get a much better understanding as to what this chazal is sharing with us. And to begin, let me start with an observation. The Rambam in Hilchos Yesodi Torah says it is a mitzvah to love Hashem, it is a mitzvah to fear Hashem. Ask the Rambam, how does one do this? How does one come to a passionate, powerful sense of the awe of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence? How does one come to appreciate Hashem? How does one come to love Hashem? And says the Rambam, it's actually a very simple formula. Derech Lav, also the way to love Hashem, is she is bonin ha'adam ha'maisav. Man should look out at the world, contemplate, look at this world, the complexity, the harmonious systems, look at nature, study it. When you do that, says the Rambam, immediately, ohev u'mashabeach u'mafa'er, immediately you'll love, you'll praise, your heart will be filled with such an awe when you see the majesty of the physical creation. When you see nature, when you see science, and when you see the systems involved, when you study it, you'll come to recognize, if this is the creation, what does it tell me about my creator? And immediately you'll come to a sense of awe, a sense of love, wanting to sing out praise to our creator. That's the Rambam. Here's the question. According to the Rambam, it should be obvious that every scientist should be a mamin. But not only should every scientist should be a mamin, every single scientific journal should say the words, "In God we trust." Every single scientific gathering should have some sort of prayer service beginning, because didn't the Rambam tell us the most sure, guaranteed way to love Hashem, to fear Hashem, is to study science? So here's the question. These men and women spend their days, nights, often sleepless nights, their entire career focused on understanding but one small part of Hashem's very, very vast, wide world. Shouldn't that be the greatest group of ma'aminim in the world? And while it's true that maybe 50% of the scientific community believe in a creator, there's a full 50% that are not just heretics, vowed atheists. And here's the question. Why is that? How is that possible? And I'd like to share with you what I consider the answer to that question. You see, your intentions don't color your actions. Your intentions define them. What that means in plain language is, if you look at the world and ask, what do I see? If you start with a tabula rasa, fine, clean white slate, and ask, what does my eye see? What does my mind tell me? You'll see Hashem, you'll see a creator, beyond any doubt. But if you start with preconceived notions, if you start with the objective that, listen, this God idea just makes me uncomfortable, don't introduce some deity into my lifestyle, coming in with that attitude, you could have the most clear, obvious proofs. It doesn't matter. Don't confuse me with the facts. My mind is made up. And this is exactly the point. The greatest formula for seeing Hashem will not succeed if you're using it incorrectly, if you're approaching it from the wrong angle, if your objective is to disprove God or anything of the like. And I believe that that's exactly the answer to one of the questions. But before we go there, one more observation. In the 1950s, nurses were trained to stand up when a doctor walked into the room. A doctor was a man of learning, a man of wisdom, and everyone knew to treat such a man with respect, including the people who worked with him, nurses, and other people. In the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s in America, there was a tremendous sense of respect, rights, law and order, and a real understanding that people are deserving of honor. In our days, that is history. This now is what I call the land of disrespect. We disrespect everyone. Presidents are disrespected. Politicians are disrespected. Teachers are disrespected. Across the gamut of the society, it doesn't matter what your position is. It doesn't matter who you are. Disrespect is the law of the land, and the media's job seems to be that watchdog to make sure that if anyone is respected and looked up to, we're going to dig in, we're going to find the dirt, and we're going to make it clear to everyone to see. While there are many fallacies with that, and while it's a pretty sketchy way to run a society, I have one observation to share with you. Rich people don't get covered. Powerful people don't get covered. Today, the only people who really get unmitigated, real respect are Talmidei Chachamim. You see the way people hover around Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. I was at a wedding, and Rav Pinchas Scheinberg walked in. You could see the entire place, every eye turned. but no one maligns him. No one writes articles, you know the dirt about this Guttel, you know what I know about him. It's real, genuine respect. Real, genuine respect as in wishing to emulate and wishing to be like, holding in high esteem. If you'd like to know the answer to this Gemara, I believe that the Jewish nation in the time of the Churban Bayis had succeeded dramatically in creating a Torah culture. Torah was choshuv. You got honor, you got respect for Limud Torah. You wanted your daughter to marry a Talmid Chacham. You wanted your son to be a Talmid Chacham, because everyone understood that honor accord and respect is given to one who is steeped in Torah study. And amazingly, if you'd like to know why they learned, it wasn't for the mitzvah. The Gemara tells us it was because we had created a culture of Torah. We had created a culture, it was respected, it was looked up to, and people learned because that was making it, that was respectable, that was how one distinguished himself. And I believe that's also shot in why the Torah didn't work. You see, if you study science for the objective of disproving God, read Richard Dawkins. He's one of the outspoken evolutionists today. Every time I open one of his books, I'm nishtomim, the wisdom of Hashem's world, layer after layer of complexity. He's an Oxford-trained zoologist. He's brilliant. And he'll show you depths and layers of complexity that I never saw. And every time I open one of his books, I'm like, wow, marabu masech Hashem. And then he reaches a conclusion, and this too evolved. He just spent page after page explaining the complexity, things that are so beyond human understanding, things that are so involved, and his conclusion is, and this too evolved. So if this evolved, so too can 100 billion stars, and so too can 100 billion galaxies, the whole world evolved. And here's the Pella. You could have everything right there. You could have the greatest revelation of Hashem's majesty and awe, but if you don't want to see it, you won't see it. And I believe that's what the Gemara is sharing with us. If you learn Torah for the wrong reasons, it's not going to work. Torah has a power. It changes a person. A person grows. It empowers him. His neshama lights up. But that's only if you do it for the right reason. That's only if you do it to serve Hashem. Learning not lishma means I'm an Eved Hashem. I need some help. It's difficult for me to get out of bed in the morning, so I'm going to set goals. I'm going to be the best guy in Shir. I'm going to be the best guy in the Beis Medrash. That's using Torah not lishma to serve Hashem. My goal is to serve my Creator. My goal is to become Kadosh V'Tar because that's what Hashem wants. I'm using elements of respect, of kavod, to help me, to propel me. But if it becomes an object in and of itself, if Torah becomes the reason why you get respect, and you begin pursuing it not for its real reasons, not because Hashem said to do it, but because it becomes its own separate rationale, reason, and force, it no longer functions. And I believe that's exactly what the Ron's explaining to us. The Klai Yisrael in the time of the first Beis Hamikdash was steeped in Torah study. They were very, very involved. Why didn't the Torah protect them? Why didn't it do its job? Because they were learning for the wrong reason. They kept learning. Tamid, says the Ron, they were constantly learning. But because it was for covet, because it was for outside reasons, because it wasn't to learn to serve their Creator, it didn't do its job, it didn't function, and the result was that the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. Whilst this is an interesting concept, I believe it's extraordinarily applicable in our day and age, and I'll explain to you why. As Rebbetzin Fuchs mentioned, the Shmooze has some popularity today, and I get a lot of phone calls, emails, people want to talk, problems, issues, and I get a chance to experience a lot of what's going on. A woman comes to my office, young woman, married, and she begins asking me some questions. The question centered around the following line of thought. Culturally, I accept everything that we do. As a matter of fact, I like Yom Tov, Shabbos, the family, it's wonderful. But all these technicalities, the keeping of Shabbos and Lulav and Esrog and Matzah, do we really have to do that? Is that really what Hashem wanted? Is that like the Rabbanan? Is that like, where'd that come from? The strange part about that conversation is this woman was not a Baal Shtuva, a young, happily married woman with a child who went to the best yeshivas you could imagine, the frumest yeshivas you've probably ever heard of. And she was asking me this question. And I sort of wanted to draw out a little bit to hear, and the line went on and on. I kept probing for the following. Is there abuse? Is she emotionally unbalanced? What's going on? She was happily married, reasonably wholesome, loved her husband, loved the child, but just didn't understand the answer to this question. So at a certain point, I said the only thing I could say, and that was, ma'am, with all due respect, if I were sitting in your shoes, I would go back to the yeshivas that I attended and I would ask for my tuition back. I think you should go back to your grade school, to your high school, to your seminary, and demand back every penny of tuition. Because the very basics of what we're doing here, the very basics of Yahdus, the very basics of our religion seem to be lacking from your education. But here was the worst problem. She was well educated. She wasn't a youth at risk when she was growing up. She wasn't a D student. A regular, fully functional woman who had these problems. You'll say to me, okay, it's unusual, it's an anecdote, but it's not really relevant. Ask your average 40-year-old Beis Yaakov graduate, what did you learn in grade school? What did you learn in high school? Yirmiyah, Yechezkel, Siftei Chachamim, every Ramban in Chumash. Did you learn Yerushalayim? Did you learn Avas Hashem? Did you learn what it means to be Mesakein Yemidos, how you work on your character traits, what the mitzvah is, how one does it? I was speaking to a young man, actually I had a long relationship with him. He got into some trouble, he ended up becoming addicted, and he went to an AA meeting. He didn't just go to an AA meeting, one of the Alcoholics Anonymous, as you know, there are various Alcoholics Anonymouses for various issues and problems, and he began going to meetings, and it was really very helpful. He began growing. As you probably know, the first step in the 12 steps is accepting a higher power. And they drill it in like a mantra. You can't solve your problems. Admit that it's beyond you. Accept a higher power in your life. And over, that's the first step. Anyway, this fellow began going to the AA meetings and was doing pretty well. I hadn't spoken to him in a while. And a few months later, he called on the phone and I asked him, how you doing? And he said, well, religiously, not so good, but spiritually great. I was a bit religiously not so good, but spiritually great. So I really wanted to know, what does that mean? So I asked him, what do you mean religiously not so good, but spiritually great? He said, well, religiously, you know, tefillin and davening and learning, not much. But spiritually, seeing Hashem in my daily life, seeing Hashem right there, I'm doing great at that. And that took me for a very, very powerful spell, and I'll explain to you why. Religion, in his mind, means putting on tefillin and shuckling, and I guess learning, but spirituality is something he just discovered, that God is in his life, that Hashem is involved in his day-to-day activity. That's something he had to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting to learn this new thing called spirituality. He went to the best yeshivas in North America. And the strangest part is that the Ramban says very clearly, the tachlis, the focus of all mitzvahs is leida es Hashem, to know HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to see Hashem, to relate to Hashem. And apparently, the practice of religion refers to external things that we do, but spirituality, which means seeing Hashem, relating to Hashem, finding Hashem in my life in a real way, I don't know, it's not exactly part of the religion. And this is something that I think is very, very problematic. And while these are anecdotes, I don't think they're mere, you know, blips on the radar screen that aren't relevant. And I've been studying this issue for many, many years, and it's gotten worse and worse. And it got to the point where I really felt very strongly about this. I was invited to speak at the last Torah Masorah Convention, and I got up in front of hundreds of mechanchim. My session was very, very well attended. It was packed. Hundreds of mechanchim, and I said the following. We are doing a great job teaching Tosas. We're doing a phenomenal job of educating our young men and young women. They come out of yeshiva very, very knowledgeable in Torah. But are we teaching Yerushalayim? Are we teaching Avas Hashem? Are we teaching Yiras Hashem? Are we teaching what it means to recognize my Creator in my daily life? And my proposal to the group then was that we're not doing it. We're failing. And I gave a mushel. I said, imagine the following. Imagine that you were transported back in time. Imagine you got into a machine and you were transported back to Rodin pre-World War I. And you were right outside the Chafetz Chaim's house. As you know, the Chofetz Chaim used to have a boydom, some sort of small attic that he would often go into to be alone. And you got to hear, as the Chofetz Chaim was speaking, no one was there, he was having a private conversation. And this is what you overheard. Hashem, I love you. Hashem, I passionately, madly love you. Hashem, I would do anything for you. Give up my wealth, my health, my life. Hashem, I love you. Needless to say, you'd be moved. Wow, what a tzaddik, what a great person. Twice a day we say in Shema, V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha, b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, v'chol miyadecha. Hashem, I love you. Hashem, I love you with all of my heart. Willing to give up my life now. With anything that's precious to me, there's nothing that's more precious than my love for you. And those aren't supposed to be words. You're mechuyev to have kavana. You're obligated to understand what those words mean and intention when you say them. So if you think that Yirat Shamayim is a tangent to our religion, if you think it's not really essential, it's a little bit problematic. And I have a sense that what we're doing, to a large extent, is what I call teaching people to be fans. And I'll explain to you what I mean. When my daughter was 12 years old, she was Lo Aleinu, she was a Yankee fan. Think of the Yankees. And I remember one time, we're in the van, we're driving, and everybody's in the van. And one of my younger daughters, who was then about maybe 5-6 years old at the time, as we passed Shea Stadium, she started booing. Boo! And the other kid said, why are you booing? Why am I booing? Because that's Shea Stadium. I mean, the Mets play there. So one of my other kids said, so what? Well, don't you know? We're Yankee fans. The Mets, ooh, Yankees, yay. So one of the children said to my 5-year-old daughter, do you know what they do in the stadium? You know what baseball is? You know how to play the game? So what do you mean you're a Yankee fan? I don't know, but the Yankees are good. Now, it's okay for a 5-year-old to say, I'm a Yankee fan, I'm on that team, and that's good. But when you have mature adults whose conception of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, their understanding of Hashem is, I don't know much about Hashem, but I'm a fan. Yeah, God's good, I'm good, yeah. Frum is good. Emunah bitachon, I don't know what they mean, but yeah. Supposed to have emunah. What does that mean? I don't know. It's good. Bitachon, what does that mean? I don't know, but I'm a fan. I'm on Hashem's side. Again, if you're 5 years old, it's not a problem. If you're a mature adult functioning, that's a very real issue. And my contention that I spoke publicly, the term of our convention was, I said, we're doing a great job teaching Tosis, we're doing a terrible job teaching Yirat Shamayim. Now, needless to say, I went out on a limb. And needless to say, I knew that I was going to catch a firestorm as soon as I got off the podium. And I was ready for it, but I didn't care. They weren't paying my mortgage anyway, so I said it, and I got off the podium prepared. What was the result? One mechanech came over to me and said, that's a true, in our yeshiva we do teach that. But that was it. No tomatoes being thrown. No, how dare you, it's chutzpah, it's not even true, it's sheker v'kozev. And mechanech after mechanech basically saying, you're right, you know, some extent, maybe 100%, maybe 80%, maybe 50%, but you're making a valid point. And I think that is a very, very compelling and very, very powerful point. However, I want to share with you something interesting. This is not news. This is not a modern phenomenon. The Chovos Avovos was written by a Rishon approximately 1,000 years ago. The Chovos Avovos is one of the great works in Musar, and in his introduction, he explains what made him write this book. And he explains that there was a man, a tremendous Talmud Chacham, who taught for 35 years. One day, a certain person in his community came over and asked him a complex question in Hilchos Gittin. The Rav looked at this man and said, that's a very, very interesting question. 35 years I've been paskening halacha. 35 years I've been teaching. Not once have I been asked that question. Not once have I thought about it. Let me ask you a question. Those mitzvahs that are applicable to you on a daily basis, loving Hashem, fearing Hashem, working on your midos, becoming a dove, clinging to Hashem, have you spent as much time in those areas as you have in these intricate issues of Hilchos Gittin? explains the Chovos HaLevavos. He wrote that book for that reason. Chovos HaLevavos means obligations of the heart, duty of the hearts, because he was speaking to a very firm audience, a very learned audience, an audience of people who are steeped in Torah learning, but the essence of it, what he calls the Chovos HaLevavos, Yirah Shamayim, Ahavas Hashem, Tikkun Amidos, Dveikus Bashem, all of that was lacking. And again, he wrote that book for that purpose. Let's call that exhibit number one. I find exhibit number two even more compelling. Mr. Othalanta says that all Musa works are great, but the greatest of all of them is the Mesillas Yesharim. Ask any fellow learning in yeshiva, ask most girls who got a good Beis Yaakov education, what's the essence of defining our religion, the essence of Avodas Hashem, the Mesillas Yesharim walks you through a path, and specifically the first parak. That defines exactly what we're here for, why Hashem created us, what life is about. That book, interestingly enough, is Rav Moshe Chaim Lusato's second version. As you may know, he wrote that book in a different format earlier on. The format that we have, which is called the Mesillas Yesharim, is edition or draft number two. Draft number one was in a vikuach, in a dialogue format. And in draft number one, you see a radical difference in the style, approach, and pointedness where he's headed. And he alludes to it in the introduction. Mesillas Yesharim is based on a formula. Rav Pinchas ben Yair is formula for perfection. Torah brings to Zahirus. Zahirus brings to Zrizus. If you study Torah, it makes you empowered. It gives you the energy that brings you to carefulness. You begin to understand the ramifications of your actions. You begin to look at the results. You begin to look at the consequences 2 years down the line, 20 years down the line. That brings you to Zrizus. You begin to value things differently. Material possessions and things of the ilk have no meaning anymore. You understand real values, so you get a new sense of gravity, a new sense of power as you pursue true goals. That leads you on to the next step of Nikias, which leads you on and on, eventually till you reach the level of Trias Amesin. A wonderful progression, step-by-step ladder of growth. But if you read the Mesillas Yesharim, you notice that there's no discussion about the first rung on the ladder. The whole concept of learning Torah, what it's about, how it functions, why do it, is left out. Nelam, not discussed. He begins at rung two. He starts with watchfulness. He starts with zehirus. And here's the question. If the man is introducing us to Avodas Hashem, if this is the ultimate work of serving our Creator, isn't Limud HaTorah step one on the ladder? Shouldn't he dedicate 3-4 parakim to it? And in the first book, you have the answer to why he didn't dedicate a single parak to it. You see, the first book is a dialogue between a chacham and the chassid. The chacham is a man who's holding in kol HaTorah kula. He knows shas, he knows poskim, he knows everything. And he meets this other man who's equally learned, equally as deep, but this other man spends a lot of time in his bonus thinking about Hashem, thinking about how he could grow in Hashem, studying those mitzvahs, and there's a vikuach, a dialogue back and forth. And the dialogue centers around one simple point. What is the essence of serving Hashem? The Chacham agrees it's Avas Hashem, to love Hashem, to fear Hashem, to see Hashem in our life. Ask the Chassid to the Chacham, tell me, how much time have you spent on those mitzvahs? Not a lot at all. Have you spent a tenth of the time that you spend about Shor Shanaka Chasapara? Have you spent a hundredth of the time as you spend learning about what qualifies or disqualifies a shofar? No. Eventually, the point that the Mesillas Yesharim wants to bring forth is brought out, and that is that if you're spending this much energy learning parts of Torah that will not really change you, how much more so you have to focus on things that are nogea, applicable on a daily basis, how much energy, how much time, how much focus you have to spend on mitzvahs that are the essence of what we're doing. And the reason why Torah was left out of the Mesillas Yesharim is because the world he was speaking to were completely, totally engrossed in Torah study. They didn't need chizuk in that. They were keeping siddurim, very, very long siddurim. They were learning 3, 4, 5, maybe 8 hours a day. Those were the balabatim. He didn't have to lecture them about, you got to keep a Seder, guys. You got to learn. It's important. They were doing that. The problem was it stopped there. And what the Chovos of Ovis calls the duties of the heart, the essence of everything was lacking, was missing. And I dare say that at some level that's where we're holding today. Torah flourishes today in a way that it hasn't probably in 2,000 years. They say since the great yeshivas of Sura and Pupadisya, there's never been as much full-time learning as there is today. Torah flourishes. It's beautiful. But the question I think that we have to ask is, okay, but is it a complete package? Is there something missing? Are we training our young men and young women to be Yorei Elokim? Are we training them in Menshelchkeit? Are we training them in what davening really means? Are we training them in recognizing Hashem and growing as a human being? And if the answer is no, then we're failing. We're failing miserably. And Rahman al-Islam, the results of such a failure are catastrophic. I was interviewed on a radio program not long ago, and I didn't realize what I was getting myself into, but the person had read the Stop Surviving, Start Living book, and he was very moved by it, and he wanted to discuss it on the air. And at a certain point, he asked me the following question. He says, is Hashem happy with us? Is Hashem happy with the Jewish nation now? So I may not be the brightest guy in the block, but I was sharp enough to get out of that one. I said to him, that is the job of a Navi, Yeshaya HaNavi, Yirmiyah HaNavi, to come and say, Ko Amar Hashem, I'm happy or I'm displeased. That's not our job. We don't have that breath of knowledge. We don't have that breath of vision. But I do want to share with you something very, very compelling. If you would have looked at the state of Torah in 1945, if you would have looked at the future of the Jewish nation in 1945, you would have written it off forever. Hitler succeeded in killing one-third of the physical bodies of the Jewish nation, but his success was far greater. Every great yeshiva in Europe, every corner that had a shul, that had a Beis Medrash, the great Torah scholars, the great yeshivas were in Europe, were in Poland, were in Russia. Everything was obliterated. In 1945, in the United States of America, Rav Moshe Feinstein had a small yeshiva on the Lower East Side, 20, 30 men around the table. Rav Aaron Cutler had a very small yeshiva. My father-in-law learned in the early days back there, and he described what it was like. A certain balabas came over to Rav Aaron with a taina. Rav Aaron had plans to build a new Beis Medrash. The man came over to Rav Aaron and said the words, Rosh Yeshiva, what in the world do you need a Beis Medrash that's so large? There's room for maybe 200 guys in that Beis Medrash. What in the world would you need such a large Beis Medrash? It's a waste of money. That was one of the good balabatim. Had you assessed the future of the Jewish nation in 1945, any intelligent observant would have said, it's over, finished, kaput, done with. The great melting pot called America, the great land of assimilation. You shave off the beard and the payas, you act like a Yankee, and you give it up. Anyone would have said it's over. There are not 200 guys learning in Lakewood today. There are 6,000 men learning Torah full-time. Look at the Mir Yerushalayim. Look at every street corner in Brooklyn that has one yeshiva larger than the next, larger than the next, larger than the next. I don't want to date myself around here, folks, but I grew up in the Young Israel of Kugon Hills. When I was 19, I went to yeshiva. I grew up in yeshiva, but I went to Chofetz Chaim when I was 19, and I remember the first time that I put on a hat. I came back to the Young Israel, and I put on a hat, and it felt like every eye was peering at me. I was the center of attention, and it was very uncomfortable because it was a little unusual coming from that sort of background to now be in yeshiva. That's not the world we live in. The world we live in is very, very different. You can't get a good shidduch unless you're in yeshiva. And many guys should be working, but they're not because I got to get a shidduch. I can't, I got to sit there and battle my whole day because, you only get respect, honor, for being involved in learning. And Baruch Hashem, on one level, it's phenomenal. We have succeeded in creating a Torah culture. We have our own magazines. We have our own radio programs. There's so much Torah that's flourishing and growing on one level, it's astonishing, it's beautiful, it's wonderful. However, the question is it enough? And is there a component missing? And what this Gemara in the Dharma is telling us is you can have a generation that's steeped in Torah study. That was the generation of the Churban. They were learning, says the Ran, Tamid, constantly, and to the extent that Chachamim and Nevi'im looked at the surface, and they looked at the generation, they couldn't find the flaw. That means they were doing a very good job of learning Bahasmada. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu revealed what the problem was. Azavtem es Torasi. It's not that you weren't learning, but you were learning for the wrong reasons. And if you don't learn for the right reason, the Yerushalayim doesn't come, the Avos Hashem doesn't come, the Torah doesn't do its job. It won't protect you. It won't be mugging. And learning is phenomenal. Learning is great, even if you do it not lishma. But it has to be not lishma because it's Hashem's Torah. It has to be not lishma because ultimately I crave a relationship with my Creator. And I want to serve Him. I want to grow. And if that element is lacking, Rachman al-Tzlan, it doesn't work. We live in rather unique times. Never in the course of history have we been in this sort of strange, almost at the top of the mountain, and it's hard to know which way we're going. Are we going up? Are we going down? Are we going off the cliff? Let me give you a perspective about what I mean. Simon Wasserman was born in Berlin in 1910. He grew up in the regular German school system. In 1933, when Hitler came to power, he read Mein Kampf, and he got scared. Terrified is a better word. It happened to be that an older sister of his had gone to Israel and made Aliyah, and he decided that he too, he's got to get out. He's got to escape. So he applies for a visa. He was flatly refused. Remember, the British government was not exactly welcoming Jews into Palestine at the time. So he asked, how could I do it? How could I get to immigrate? They explained to him, you must have a trade that's very much needed in Palestine. What trade is needed? Elevator technicians. So he went to school for a year to study how to be an elevator technician, got his degree. With his degree, he got permission to immigrate, and he landed on then Palestine's shores. Okay. In 1938, he gets a letter from a school friend of his, a friend of his from the olden days who he had been very close with. They went to grade school together for many, many years, and the letter reads as follows. I am now a high-ranking officer in the Gestapo, and I'm writing this letter with great danger to myself, but because of our friendship, I'm explaining to you where things are at. I just saw a list. Your father, your mother, your brother, and your two sisters are on this list of Jews to be exterminated. And he signs the letter, and that's the end. And Simon Wasserman says to himself, this is crazy, what do I do? Maybe it's a trap, maybe they're trying to get me, is he honest or not? I don't know, he asks people back and forth and back. He finally decides, it's too risky, I can't just sit back and allow my parents, my brothers, sisters to be annihilated. In 1939, he travels from Palestine back to Germany, and he sits down with his family, shows them the letter, explains to them the grave danger, and they said to him as follows, you're a fool. It can't happen here. You're out of it. You have no idea. It can't possibly be. And Simon Wasserman left empty-handed, and not long after, his mother, his brother, his parents were killed, his whole family were destroyed. My friends, you know, no one here is a Navi. No one here makes predictions, but in a very real sense, we're almost that sort of, it feels like 1933. In the world today, there are 1.5 billion Muslims. 1.5 billion. How many of those peace-loving people are radical Islamics? So read the press, read the media, but when you carefully read it and you carefully analyze the studies, you find that a lot more than you thought are what we call radical Islamics. Recent studies show something like 37% would answer the following question affirmatively. Do you feel that the destruction of the World Trade Center was partly or fully justified? 37% of Muslims worldwide answered yes. Fully, or at least partly justified. my friends, if it's not 37%, let's say it's 25% of the Muslim world are radical Islamics who would love to do nothing other than die to end the Jews' life. We're talking about roughly 375 million people. 50 countries worldwide have Muslim majorities. Iran is either has or is at the precipice of nuclear armament. From Tehran to Tel Aviv is 33 minutes. A missile taking a nuclear warhead takes 33 minutes from Tehran to Tel Aviv, and not much longer to Washington, by the way. In a very real sense, when you read the papers and you see what's going on, it's frightening. But what's especially frightening is it's hard to know what the next step is. In a real sense, it seems like Torah has risen from the ashes. From the destruction of our nation, we've now come back alive. Torah study flourishes as it never did before. Yiddishkeit, growth, Kiruv Rechokim. We built back up the land of Israel, which was a desolate, barren desert. And it's built up into a metropolis after metropolis, a powerful city-state. All the signs of Ut right there, Mashiach being one step away, they're all there. I talk on a regular basis to Bali Tshuva with 12-minute walks from Har Sameach, and I have guys over on a regular basis. There's a rule at the Schaefer House. Any guy is welcome, but you got to pay a price for the meal. The price is you got to tell your story. And each guy who comes, before he gets to the soup, somewhere between the fish and the soup, he's got to tell his story, and there's a hush at the table. My kids sit there with jaws agape, listening. You hear the hashkacha, you hear the guy's story. He came, his grandparents didn't have any connection to Yiddishkeit. They never lit Shabbos candles, didn't know anything. And he saw something and he started growing and he's a frum ben Torah. And when you hear story after story after story, you begin to get it. We're living in unique times. And it seems like we're heading right up. It seems like we're almost there. One more step and Mashiach comes and this long, bitter exile is over. But that's the question. What is the next step? If the Yerushalayim was present, there'd be no question, we'd be there, and we're headed that way, and it's but one more step. But if the essence of it all, if the Yerush Hashem, if the Avas Hashem, if the working on one's character traits, if that whole thing called Dveikus by Hashem, seeing Hashem and clinging to Hashem is lacking, then the Torah can't do its job. It can't function, it can't accomplish. And if it doesn't, Rahman al-San, our enemies are waiting. They are right there. And they're powerful, and it's rather scary. It's rather frightening times. I'm not an alarmist in any sense, and I've been an adult for a couple of years now, but I've never had this sense of pachad, strange events happening, one after another, strange things, and eventually you get it. Hashem runs the world. Hashem sends messages. Hashem sends very clear messages. And the question is, do we as a nation get it? Do we wake up? Do we understand? Do we reach that one final recognition, Hashem Elokim, and we end this exile? Or do, Rahman, do we blow it, and who knows what the next step is, and the exile continues? Hashem grant us that this be the first Tisha B'Av that we celebrate, that it not be spent on sackcloth and ashes, that it be spent in a rebuilt Beis HaMikdash, Hashem, and our long exile. Do we have any, before I stop, does anyone have questions, thoughts, observations? Take questions, yeah.
Okay, we're ready. What do we have to do? You told us we're at. What do you suggest we do? I mean, it's not about more learning, it's not about what is your suggestion and how to find the city with
us? Okay, that's a very fine question. Let me just repeat the question because the microphone doesn't work so well. The question is, this is all fine and well, but what's the next step? What do we do about this? Right. Okay. So, I got to be attentive. Just, if you want to, please feel free to leave. You know, don't feel free to stay, but we can discuss this for a minute. In any case, I think the answer to this question really is simple and very complex at the same time. Identifying the problem is 80% of the solution. You see, just like, you know, at the Torah Masorah Convention when we discussed it and people there started saying, you're right, we have to focusing on it, thinking about what we can do, what programs we can institute, whether it be curriculum in schools, whether it be things we teach in the house, there has to become much more of a focus. Again, this is what the Sula Sharma was saying in his introduction, this is what the Chovas Levavos was saying, and this is a big part of what's needed. And again, a lot of times it's focusing. I don't want to before I lose the floor, before pandemonium breaks out, or the tomatoes start getting thrown on like the Torah Masorah Convention, let me just mention, there's a book that I wrote that recently came out that's I'm not telling you this is an answer, but it's on the first parak Masorah Sharma. It's called Stop Surviving, Start Living. It's a very powerful, I like to call it the first parak of Masorah Sharma in 21st century language. What it does is it takes the big deal issues. Why did Hashem create me? Why am I doing it? Why is this suffering? What do you mean I'm a ben olam haba? I'm going to live out. My body's dead. What do you mean I'll be alive? It deals with a lot of the issues that a thinking firm person should deal with. We have copies here available. It's extremely discounted. They're in paperback for $8. The reason they're very discounted is because I believe it's a very critical work and needs to get out there. There are also many shmuzim online that you could download and podcast to deal with the full gamut of Yerushamayim, of Avos Hashem, of Avodas Hashem. Please feel free to access them. I don't think we're going to be able to take a question and answer because I think it's a little too a little too noisy. But let's afterwards, people come over, please, and feel free to ask, and I'll gladly discuss things in private. And if you want, the books are available for $8. You can just leave the money in the box, take a copy. Please take a moment. There are also other tape series and books.